Joshua chapter 10 is our chapter for this week. So if you'd make your way over there, we'll talk a little bit about what you're going to be encountering in the Bible reading this week. Actually, you know, we've been saying for several weeks now that although Joshua is a book about the conquest, not a lot of about military stuff and battles and stuff. It's been
the
stories, right?
Yeah, the first, you know, eight chapter, or from chapter two to chapter eight, are primarily just about Jericho and Ai. And the whole point is really the contrast, you know, you follow God completely, it's easy.
Yeah. Rahab and Achan, those are big stories that take up a lot of
and
attention.
If there's sin in the camp, it'll go badly quickly. Right. I mean, just, you know, and that's, you know, so the bulk of, you know, what's the story just focusing on, you know, follow God, that's easy. Don't disobey God, and it's hard. Because what's interesting, too, is, you know, didn't he have that Gibeonite episode in which they didn't acquire the Lord? But chapter 10's the first time they go back into battle again.
Yes.
And
it's nothing but battles.
Yeah. Yeah. This is their big sweep through the south.
Yeah. So we'll throw our map back up that we used a few weeks ago so you can kind of take a look at what we'll call this the Southern Campaign. How about that? Because they start with Jericho and Ai, and they move from east to west, and now they're going to end up. Their hand is kind of forced on this, right?
Yeah, because now they're Gibeonites are technically their responsibility,
right? But all of that is going to pull them down to the south because there's going to be a Southern alliance of kings, which evidently is the new way of handling this.
By city's not working.
We'll gang up on them,
yeah,
and see if we can defeat Israel that way. And so, as they take on this alliance, they just wind up working their way down south and conquering this southern region, sort of going. It's kind of like the Pacific War, World War II, kind of hopping from island to island.
Island hopping.
We're hopping back from city to city. So anyway, and that's really, in terms of what's in the chapter, it's just the story of that, the story of the enemies conspiring and come up together against Gibeon and Israel intervening, and then all of these battles with all of these cities that follow.
Yeah, you know, though, of course, a big part of the story is, you know, again, if you know, we spent so much time on Jericho and Ai to emphasize how easy it is, how God handles all the hard stuff if they obey him and do it his way. Versus when they sit in the camp, you know, Ai happens, death happens, failure happens. You know, now that they're going back into battle for the first time, you know, we usually focus on, you know, the sun standing still part of the story. But the truth of the matter is, it's God's hand all over this. It's God throwing them into chaos. It's God throwing stones that kill them. You know, I mean, just all this miraculous, you know, work of God just making short work of, again, to your point, you know, here you have this much larger allied force, you know, coming after them. And yet God is just, you know, they're not really doing, in a sense, it's really not about what they're doing to combat this or better tactics or better armament. God's just dealing with it. It's not a big deal.
It's almost like you march around the walls and they fall down.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing. Yeah, yeah. There's just a number that we focus on the big one, the sun standing still part. But if you read this, it's God's fingers are all over this.
Yeah, let's make a point. You bring up the sun standing still and that's one of those places where Bible critics are really going to double down and say, what an absurd notion.
Sure.
And just a quick word about that if Genesis 1 and 2 are true, this is no big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
This is, people are critical, you know, the Bible is offering up the absurd. Well, that's only because you begin with the presupposition that God doesn't exist.
Right.
If God is the creator, it's not difficult to make the sun stand still, and whatever he would need to adjust accordingly to make that work.
Remember, the laws of nature, as we are really just our descriptive efforts to notice the regularity of how nature works. The invisible abstract laws of nature, gravity, speed of light, whatever, they only work because God wills it to be so. Yep. I mean, we forget. I mean, we kind of, if we're not careful, even as Christians, we get caught in the scientific worldview, even if we're explicitly denying evolution. But we still get caught in the scientific materialist worldview where somehow God himself is bound to the laws of nature. The laws of nature are themselves expressions of the will of God for his creation.
Yeah.
And so if God wants there to be light without what we consider to be the laws of nature that make light work a certain way, you know, or the rotation of the earth, you know, for the sake of the water not flying everywhere, you know, the tides, you know, God can do whatever God jolly well pleases, and it will all still work just fine because it's all grounded in his will that it is so, not the laws of nature. And that's why, by the way, I think this passage is a great place. One of the objections that sometimes people make to a non-literal, reading Genesis 1 is non-literal, is, well, you know, if there's an evening in the morning, you know, in the first 3 days before the sun, moon, and stars are created, then that's proof is also allegory. The problem is here's an example of the fact that you've got time and another thing going on just fine without the heavenly body's motions.
Right.
You know, that's the whole thing. The heavenly bodies, you know, or at least the sun and the moon. I mean, you know, because somebody else wants to know, you know, well, does that mean that the other planets stopped in their orbits? Or, you know, I don't know. I mean, you're missing the point.
Right.
You're missing the point. The point is, but again, the laws of nature are not binding God either. God can make nature work without what we consider to be the laws. The laws are just our descriptions of the regularity of nature. There is nothing law about them from God's perspective.
And the even bigger issue there was not to keep the lights on so they could finish the battle. The bigger issue is, I am the one that's giving you the victory.
Well,
you are able to pull this off because I am helping you defeat your enemies. And it is that demonstration that when you go with God, when you work with God, then God then gives you the victory. And that's what's really happening in the story.
And again, just the ease of them taking the land when God's doing all the heavy lifting and all these, you know, what we, you know, these miraculous ways.
Yeah. That is actually a point that's emphasized throughout this text. In fact, it's almost redundant in the text that they utterly destroyed the city as God had told them to do. And so now we have that contrast with Achan, who is taking stuff he's not supposed to take,
right?
And not following God's plan and God's order. There almost just seems to be this redundant emphasis. This time, they did what God told them to do, and things went according to plan. Things worked out as they would want them to work out.
That's right. Yeah, no, that's exactly right.
So we probably should comment again, because I think people get real hung up about this too, about the fact that that they're utterly destroying cities.
Yeah.
And I don't see how you get around that this means they are killing men, women, and children. They're completely annihilating the nation.
Right. You know, well, and even verse 28 again, you know, Joshua devoted to destruction, you know, that Haram principle we've been talking about.
You keep bringing that up. Say something about that Haram principle.
Yeah, well, that just God decides they're all dedicated to him, dedicated either for destruction or, but it belongs to him. It's not your choice. I'm making the call on this. You know, it's devoted to me, either to be set aside, you know, but again, the way you often set living things aside to God was by killing them so that you can't reuse them, repurpose them. And of course, with people, you know, whether it was, you know, turning women into war brides or slaves or, you know, whatever, but just, you know, and of course, in this case, it's as much, you know, the other parts of, you know, Deuteronomy and whatnot make clear. It's because God doesn't want them to become corrupted by the people's ways.
Yeah.
You know, what do we say about this? Well, several things. Number one, God's the definition of justice, not us. So if it goes against our sense of justice, we need to reboot our sense of justice. The only reason we have
we're gonna figure out where we get the sense of justice.
Well, that's literally about to say that the problem, you know, that's the irony of trying to judge God's justice is the only reason we have a sense of justice, unlike all the other animals, is because we bear the divine nature, which means we have to calibrate ourselves by, you know, just like with love, just like with so many other virtues, there's the world's perversions and counterfeits that we often mistake for. No, we need to calibrate these virtues, love, justice, whatever, by God's standards, not by the world's standards. That's number one. Number two is the fact that life and death belong to God. We forget we didn't give life, and so we have no right to life as we see it. Mm-hmm. That life and death are in the hand of God. And so, again, when life itself is a gift, you didn't create yourself, you don't own yourself. We forget that. We got that angle. And then there's just, you know, the single fact that, you know, sin brings death. And these are collectively a sinful people. And the collective angle, which I think what troubles people maybe the most when they really stop and think about it, is, you know, this goes against the American sense of individualistic justice. We don't punish people for the sins of the group they happen to be a part of. We judge people for their own crimes. But in the Bible, You can be personally innocent, but part of a group that is guilty and suffer the group's consequences.
Happens all the time. It happens to Israel in Scripture.
Well, ironically, I mean, and again, there are people who, and it's interesting, you know, somebody who could throw shade at God or raise questions to God about this is Daniel. Right? Because, you know, in one sense, a guy who there's nothing negative about him, yet he's in exile. He spends decades in exile. His life is risked in exile. He's punished for serving God, you know, thrown to the lions in exile. And yet he never questions God. In fact, if anything, ironically, in Daniel chapter 9, Daniel actually confesses on behalf of his nation their sins.
Right.
Because he recognizes that he's part of a sinful group and that God's judgment rightly falls on the group of which he is a part. So it's interesting. Other righteous people in the Bible, this is a uniquely modern mind problem.
The other piece I would add to that it is a vastly different thing for God to bring this kind of a judgment and for men as an act of
we get to decide these things
conquest or vengeance to go utterly wipe out a nation of people. And I say that in part because God knows the beginning from the end. God knows all things. And the presupposition that people who are critical of God in this case bring to the table is that there may not be a very good reason for why God is doing it this way. And that's the difference in all of it. He is God. He sees what we don't see.
Right.
And if we were inside his mind, how different all of that would look. So there's kind of a human arrogance disorder. Yeah. Well, to use the Old Testament prophets figure, it's the potter telling the clay telling the potter what to do.
Yeah.
We've got this completely backwards.
Yeah.
And so it's a much we're talking about what God does, and that's not like talking about what man does. It's a completely different thing.
Right. Well said.
So something to ponder, a difficult question, I think, when you're reading through this text. But this week, work your way through the battles and take note of how when the people work with God as he's told them to do, that things work out and the plan comes together. Great, great time to talk to your children about how their own lives need to be with God and working his plan.